Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is television dialogue editor Jason Brennan. But first of all, the record labels are coming back with an old friend, the compilation album. Yeah, we thought they're dead and gone, mostly because physical product is pretty much dead and gone. But the labels are frustrated with playlists, and mostly the playlists on Spotify because they're curated. So Universal Music is releasing its own playlists, and they're calling them compilation albums. And you can find these on the Appears On section of Spotify. And mostly these pertain to broad moods or events. There's not much curation, it seems. So little, in fact. There's one that's called 2019 Mix, but there's no music on it from 2019. They're also trying to capitalize on artists that aren't on their own roster. For instance, there's a couple of very interesting compilations. One is called Old Town Country Road, and of course, that's very much like Old Town Road. And another one is Hot Girl Summer, and of course, both of the artists that did these are not on that label. So they're trying to follow something that actually started quite a while ago by a Stockholm-based company called X5. And the idea was, let's create albums for the digital market. They had an initiative to try to do 50 albums a month. 50 albums a month. But again, these are playlists that we're talking about. At least they eventually became playlists. And now that's what we're looking at. Only the labels are calling them compilation albums because they're more label-centric, label-specific, than they are artist-specific. So look for that new trend, especially on Spotify. Basically, they're label-specific playlists that the labels are calling compilation albums. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my online courses on mixing, production, branding, and music business success at bobbyosinskicourses.com. Also, get an expert analysis and objective opinion of your songs and mixes as a member of my Hitmakers Club. Go to hitmakersclub.com to learn more. Okay, so a lot of you have asked about my podcasting setup. And I think I might have done a podcast a few years ago about this. But that being said, there are some differences. So let's cover them now. So I'm speaking to you right now over a Shure SM7B, and that goes into a Royer D-Booster. I used to have a Cloud Lifter, but the D-Booster just sounds a little better. There's a little bit more clarity on the top end and a little more girth on the bottom end. It just adds something that I couldn't get any other way. That's fed into a Golden Age pre-73 Neve 1073 clone preamp. I don't even remember when or where I got this. I like it though. I like the sound of it. At some point I may change, probably to a Rupert Neve Designs channel strip. Anyway, from the Golden Age mic pre, it then goes into the line in of an Apollo Twin Mark II. In the Apollo Twin, there's an LA2A plugin that's on the input. Now, to be honest with you, I'm not sure about the way this sounds. It doesn't work the way I expect a real LA2A to work. But that being said, it's there and it's not too noisy, so I use it. The output of that goes into an iMac. It's a relatively new one. It's the latest version. It's a 4.26 gigahertz iMac with an i7 processor and 24 gigabytes of RAM. There's also a second 24-inch monitor that I have. So basically what will happen is with Pro Tools, which is recording everything, one side has the edit window and the other side has the mix window. Now, the way I record the interviews, 90% of the time is via Skype or by phone. And when I talk to someone via phone, it's actually via Skype connection, so I can easily record it via Pro Tools. Occasionally, I'll go out and do something live. I'm not crazy about doing that. To be honest with you, this is a lot easier all the way around. And many times I get a better recording. That being said, sometimes because of Skype problems or just because the person I'm talking to is in a room that's boingy and reflective and just doesn't sound good, I have to treat it usually with RXD reverb, and that gets rid of it. Now, when it comes to actually doing post, there's a lot going on. Every channel has a FabFilter Pro C2 compressor on it. Not doing a lot, just touching it a little bit. 9 times out of 10, the interview via Skype or phone requires some extra treatment. This usually comes from a FabFilter Pro Q3, and I have a preset, especially for phone interviews. It compensates for the way it sounds. As a de-esser, I use a Waves F6 RTA. It's strictly set as a compressor, a multi-band compressor, and there's usually at least 3 bands and sometimes 4. Now, every channel has a noise gate on it. It's the Pro Tools D3 expander gate. Again, not doing a whole lot. Usually the range is somewhere around minus 20 or so. So it just knocks down any background noise, cleans everything up, and for the most part, it's pretty transparent. Finally, when it comes to the master bus, there's a FabFilter Pro L2. And what that'll do is that'll make sure that the LUFS level, which I monitor through the plugin, is coming in at around minus 16 LUFS. That's kind of a standard for podcasts, and it's a standard for a lot of internet delivery. And that's where we come in here too, as well. How much editing do I do? Well, quite a bit, actually. Try to make everyone sound great. And what that means is, if there's someone that's pausing a lot or doing a lot of ahs or ums, I do try to get rid of at least some of them so the flow is better. That being said, I never do any editorial editing, so what you hear is what I heard when we recorded it. Now, the output of that then goes into a pair of Amphion 118s. They're passive monitors, and they're powered with an Amphion 500, which is 500 watts a channel. Yeah, I know, it kind of bucks the trend of using powered monitors, but I really love the way these sound. They sound a lot bigger from what they are, but they're true. Everything I hear is true, and also the frequency response tends to be pretty much the same at different levels. Finally, the last thing is, when I have to use headphones during recording, I'll use a pair of Audio-Technica MX-50Xs. I also have a pair of Sennheiser HD650s I don't use all that much because they're open-backed, and it doesn't necessarily work if I have an open mic. So, that's my signal path, that's my recording path, my playback path. That's what you're hearing when you're listening now. My guest today is Jason Brennan, who's a re-recording mixer, supervising sound editor, and sound designer with numerous feature film and television credits for Warner Brothers. His 10 years of experience in music production and engineering gives him a unique outlook on television audio. Jason has always been on the cutting edge of the latest technology. He uses his experiences to develop workflows that deliver the best sound experience and goes beyond the standard sound effects library for the right sound, even if it means traveling to record it. During the interview, we spoke about what's changed in audio post in the last 5 years, the biggest problem that dialogue editors face, aligning phase on boom and lav mics, and much more. I spoke with Jason via phone from a studio not too far from the Warner Brothers main lot. Tell me about the work that you've been doing and how things have changed between, well, you know, let's say 5 years ago and now.
Like 5 years ago, I think I was doing, you know, I would have a kind of a staggering thing because I was doing the Fosters, and that kind of came usually like beginning of November and would go to like March and then start up in May and go through the summer. So it always kind of kept my summer busy. And then with some of the network shows, they're usually starting up in September. And so they would kind of overlap, which was great. And then I was ended up doing a show over at Universal, and they all just started to stack up on top of each other. So at one point I was doing 3 shows at the same time, and just working through the schedules and trying, because obviously the clients aren't going to adjust their schedule to meet one of my other clients' schedules. So I have to make it work within all of them. Sometimes need some, a little bit of help, have somebody cover for me or something like that. And, you know, the networks, I think, are kind of trying to figure out what they should be doing in terms of content and shows. So the network activity comes and goes. I've noticed over the past couple of years, there being a lot less pilots on the lots because the lots are just, they're so full with Netflix shows, Amazon shows, Hulu shows, and other things. So it's just weird. And it's just one of those times where, you know, like now the show that I was on for ABC Splitting Up Together got canceled. And then I was left with no pilot and nothing coming up. So just kind of hunting around and letting people know, hey, I'm available.
Yeah. You would think the fact that because there's so many more distributors now, so many more production companies, that there'd be a lot more work.
Exactly. I mean, and it's, you know, it kind of comes and goes, and it is a bit strange. And, you know, I don't know how the lots deal with when they're, you know, trying to quote unquote, you know, sell a supervisor or a team or whatever, and how much work they really do. So I'm, you know, basically out there, you know, knocking on doors, you know, talking to other, you know, supervisors and friends saying, hey, you know, if anything comes up, I'm available. And, you know, so it kind of gets through and, you know, so like the past, you know, few months, I've been more just doing dialogue editing than supervising, which is fine because I don't mind working.
What do you prefer?
And, supervising. I mean, if I'm doing one show and the schedule is, you know, we're not trying to get like three shows done in a week, in a week's time, I'll cut the dialogue as well as supervise it because I know how to lay it out. I know how the mixer's gonna treat it. I can, you know, do a little bit more with, you know, noise reduction. I can double cut, you know, cutting boom and lav. You know, I take the time to go through and find alts for a clunk on a line and things like that. And so it's a lot much of a smoother flow. You know, dialogue editing is great. And everyone who I've turned all my stuff into, this, you know, past few months, have all been loving it. So it's good to keep me busy, I guess, but supervising gets me out of the house.
Oh yeah.
You know, you get stuck in a room all day, and it can drive you a little batty.
Well, that said, I know that dialogue editing has changed pretty drastically recently, just from the standpoint that everybody is an indie, and you're not reporting to a place to work on their gear or anything anymore. How about supervising? Has that changed?
No, it's pretty much the same. At least what I found. Some facilities might be a little more hands-on with your supervising and things like that, where places like Warner Brothers or Universal, just like, you know what you're doing, the client, as long as you're within the budget, and if there's any overages, you let us know, they'll let you just do what you want. You know, I mean, I tend to, when I supervise, I tend to go through all of the mics on my own just to see if there's anything that's cleaner that can be used. And then I'll go through and cut alts and send them to my dialogue editor. So that's covered. Although, you know, in some respects, some of the dialogue editors always present the original with the clunk in it rather than presenting the alt, which doesn't have the clunk. You know, it seems a little backwards to me because it's like, let's present it to them clean. And if they want to go back to the original with the clunk, then we'll just unmute the region.
Yeah.
So, I mean, dialogue editing hasn't changed as much in terms of the actual process and what, like, these older people are doing. And I know we talked about, you know, doing my previous protege were going to write a book on, it's just a different approach. But, you know, you think you had mentioned, like, doing a video or something like that, but we'll have to get into that at another point in time.
How different is that approach from the way it's normally done?
It's very different in a lot of ways. It's just, I don't want to go too much into it because I don't want to give away all the secrets. And then it's like, oh, you know, and it's just, I think of it like this. It's just, it's an approach, you know. Normally with, you know, a lot of dialogue editors, they don't really kind of understand. I like to call it, it's like, when I deliver a show, you know, dialogue wise, it's mixer friendly because the mixer is going to take a look at it. They're going to feed the organization because from me being, you know, a mixer, a re-recording mixer as well, I kind of understand the workflow. And I don't think a lot of the dialogue editors really understand it. So it kind of gets a little jumbled, you know, they overthink things. They don't, I mean, I'll say one thing. The one thing I do is I like to run my dialogue through, you know, a light dialogue chain that kind of emulates how it's going to be on the stage. That don't go too crazy, you know, just a little 4-to-1, you know, compression, you know, a lot, just kind of bring the level up so I can hear things clearer, in my room. I don't like mixing with I don't like editing with headphones. Just, it feels way too, you know, that sound where it's like you put your hands, cup them over your ears. It just feels weird.
Okay. So what you're saying then is you're monitoring with a signal chain that's similar to what's going to be used on stage, but that's not what you're giving them.
No, no. So it's like, if, you know, when you dialogue from the minute it hits, the channel strip, if it's virtual or on an actual real console, which there aren't many of those these days, first thing it's going to hit is compressor to bring the level up because, you know, we'll go into another issue that I've, you know, been dealing with for the past couple of years is a lot of these production sound mixers don't think they know how to calibrate their digital gear as opposed to when they calibrated analog recorders. Because they're setting their top level at minus 20. And rather than that being that you got still got 20 more dB, it's like make your peak at minus 10. So I get booms and lobs and even the mix tracks that go to the picture editors, you have to, you know, the mix tracks you have to boost 12 dB and the boom and lob traps you literally have to boost between 20 and 30 dB just to even get a signal, which, you know, so close to the noise floor, it just brings up all the noise.
Yeah, wow.
And so it's been a struggle. And luckily on this last, in the last show I supervised and cut, I was able to contact the production sound mixer and talk to him about the levels because the previous season was really bad. And he was able to send me some test files. And I was like, hey, give me, you know, maybe 4 or 5 more dB. So he had adjusted to get those levels, and everything came in a lot better. It actually made it a lot easier for me to double cut the show.
But that being said, why do production mixers do that? Is it just a fear of overloading?
There is a fear of overloading, I think. And I also think, there's some of them who are really good. The guy that I worked with on the first 3 seasons of Shameless, he would always come to the room and we would talk, and he's like one of the best in town now. And I just think a lot of them don't understand the equipment as well, or they're really concentrating on trying to get the mix track to be right, and because that's what the picture editors use. But the mix tracks are tied. You got boom and lof in there, so you can't really, if you want a little more body, it's just more work. When you've got 2 channels, you've got a boom and a lof. You need a little more clarity, you can turn up the lof. Want a little more body, turn up the boom. It's fear, and I just think a lack of knowledge, I think, is part of it.
Okay, so you get the boom in the lav tracks. Don't you have phase cancellation to worry about?
No, there's a great, you put them in phase. You put them in phase. There's a great plugin called Auto Align Post. It's like $300, but it really brilliant plugin. It'll analyze whatever channel, you know, depending on, you know, the strength of one or the other channel, I'll pick is basically the one to model the phase or set the phase to, like, if it's the boom that I like, I'll set that one to be the primary analysis, and then the lav will align. They will align together.
Wow.
So it's like a little side chain of input. It's great. It works fast. You know, it takes a little bit of time because it's not blanket. Like, you can just highlight everything and put everything in phase, because you know, maybe if the boom is a little off mic, but has that nice little room sound to it, you're going to want to use the lav as the primary source. So you have to kind of look at what you're doing rather than just kind of trusting it to do everything. Because occasionally it'll get out. Then you just redo it.
How much cleanup do you have to do?
On which aspect of, like, are you talking about like noise?
Yeah.
It depends on the dialogue mixer. Some dialogue mixers, and I understand this because a lot of dialogue editors are just a little bit too extreme with like RX, you know, the Isotope RX. And so they push it too clean and it just takes all the life out. So some of them just like don't do anything. Others that trust somebody to do a little bit more because they know what they're doing. I do quite a bit. There's all these pop sticks, background crew noise, Dolly Creeks that you've got to clean out, very fill for, you know, to just kind of that has the same room tone, and you just paste it over top of the Dolly Creeks. Or sometimes if it's just too noisy outside, that it's a standard, just kind of, it's a loud tone, but it's not all over the place. I usually will leave that for the dialogue mixer to use the cedar on, because it you know, it's kind of one of those things that you hear it, it's like, yeah, you know, let me try it. And I always leave the original unprocessed tracks for them if they feel like, you know, it's a little too much. Let me go back and let me run it through my cedar or through something else. So it, you know, it varies. There's some shows that you're on set for most of the time, so it ends up, you know, not being too noisy.
You just mentioned cedar. I haven't heard that in a long time. I didn't even realize they're still around.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that still like them just because it has been a a go-to. It does feel pretty amazing. But I know there's some people that, you know, studios, $5,000 plug-in.
Yeah.
So it's pretty expensive. You know, I know some people use the WNS, the W43 from Waves. You know, there's some other things with RX. You can do a lot with RX, but you still have to take the time to do the processing, where, you know, Cedar, you can just run live. And with the plugins too, you can have many more.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, so, but, you know, since the last time we talked, I went a little bit into plug-in overload just because, you know, like, you never know what you're going to need for anything in particular. And there's always like annual Waves, WNAP or something like that. The plan came up and at Thanksgiving, and it was $1,300 to upgrade to Mercury. So I was like, I'm just going to do it. And actually I got that and the studio tools collection. And then eventually Abbey Road stuff, because a lot of that stuff is really cool. So I probably own everything now.
No.
it's a little obscene.
Easy to get into plug-in overload. Just with Waves.
Yeah. It'll be something like I had to do this when I was doing this show called Trial and Error with John Lithgow. They went back to like an old, like it was like a videotape interview from like 1987. They wanted kind of a wobble or what's it, wow and flutter kind of, you know, thing, and little glitches that you would see with playing back old tape. And so I ended up using the Abbey Road reel to reel, a Sound Toys, I think it was that little mini pitch there, the Altar Boy one, and H3000 plug-in to create this effect. And I spent a good day going through a whole bunch of different stuff just to kind of get that sort of sound. And I had like four different versions too.
Doesn't Isotope have a plug-in for that?
Yeah, but to get that kind of classic wow and flutter sort of thing, I didn't find anything in there that was really, I mean, yeah, it kind of had, you know, that sort of thing, but it didn't feel old.
Ah, okay.
I mean, you know, the smartest thing I probably could have done is, if I still have any, I probably should have searched through old VCR tapes. I saw the VCR. You know, record it onto an old tape and record the output of it.
Yeah, right.
But it's like digging things out, searching for stuff when you only have, you know, a day to kind of create something. So it ended up working out really well. I'll find little things, you know, here and there that I like from different companies. Yeah, the Plug-in Alliance stuff, they would come out with something and it would be like, oh, it's only $29. Sure. And then I ended up getting whatever you call it, the heavy hitters coupon every month. It was like $75 and there'd be a sale and I would get like two more for like $70. And now they offer me like $150 subscription for a year and you get everything. They've got some cool stuff. You know, they just came out with the Focusrite console. It's there if I need it. I guess that's the point.
What's the biggest problem that a dialogue editor faces?
I guess the biggest problem would be having enough time to really go back through the show. Listening to it in an environment that is going to represent the dialogue well. Because, you know, you can turn your headphones up, but you know when something's compressed, you start to hear lower, you know, things. You kind of bring it all together so you can hear everything in between, everything lower better, everything higher better. And I don't think a lot of people, just by turning up their headphones, really hear all of those things. Depending on the dialogue mixer, it's just trying to get all the angles, different angles to work, because, you know, they'll go from, you know, one shot to the next, and from take one to take six, the mic has moved three different times, and so it sounds different.
Yeah.
So just getting those to match, and making it into a sensible sort of organization in Pro Tools. Well, I just think that's just the one thing that a lot of dialogue editors don't understand is, you know, making it mixer friendly so that, you know, you're not mixing on track one and track six at the same time. You know, so you go from angle one on track one to angle two on track six to angle three on track four. So you see how the disorganization it is rather than going one, two, three and stair stepping it.
Yeah.
That I see that a lot.
I'm amazed that a dialogue editor would not be cognizant of what a mixer needs.
It is a little strange, but I think it, you know, they don't spend any time on the stage and they're not aware of their process of mixing. You know, they're just this is what I'm supposed to do. And, you know, they're just kind of going through each thing. And as long as it plays back fine, they're not really thinking about where faders are. I mean, if they've even ever touched a fader. I mean, there are people that, you know, like me who supervise cut dialogue, but there are a lot of, you know, dialogue editors out there. And it may be changing more, but from what I've seen, that just don't understand anything outside of their room. You know, they don't have a lot of time to go sit on the stage.
Yeah.
You know, where I've, you know, I spent, you know, 15 years in, you know, the effects chair before I moved to dialogue. So I got to see it all. The same sort of thing kind of happens too with some effects editors. They're not thinking in the logical, you know, sort of way. So, you know, with my effects editor, he knows, because I've trained them how to deliver things to me when I was mixing Shameless. So it ended up being a better, you know, fit when he understood my process rather than just what my layout was.
Why did you switch from effects to dialogue?
Well, it's just a natural sort of progression, I think. You know, I wanted to, you know, it's the lead chair, you know, it's kind of the lead mixer. And from, you know, supervising, it just made more sense. Dialogue and music are the two biggest things that the clients pay attention to. And I really wanted to get those, you know, sounding better. And I knew what I could, if I had a mixing partner, I knew how to direct them on what we needed to do in terms of Foley sound or, you know, just how we're going to go about a certain approach to, you know, a little bit of the sound design aspects of it.
How much does your music background come into it?
I think it comes in quite a lot, just in terms of reverbs, mixing, you know, the music, getting the balance. I mean, it comes definitely definitely comes into play when directing talent for ADR or, you know, group backgrounds, just because, you know, you kind of know how to get a performance out of somebody. If you sat in a session and you're recording vocals and you do, hey, let's do a little bit of something different, it's your ear goes there. A lot of people in post are previous from, you know, music either playing, so that a lot of people have musical ears.
Yeah, it seems that way. Seems like everybody I talk to that is in that part of the business has come from music.
Yeah. You know, I think, too, it's just music was such a small, such a smaller part of the entertainment industry, even though it seems like it's very big, but film is just huge in comparison. It dwarfs music by a mile. You know, I don't even know if record companies really even make money anymore.
Well, they do, and they make plenty.
Sure, like everybody else.
It's funny because when I first moved to California, I was told by somebody who was sort of a mentor that the hierarchy was always music, television, film. And that's the way your career should go. Of course, I never followed that. I probably should have.
Right. Oh, so you mean you like the hierarchy, meaning that film is at the top or at the bottom?
Well, no, it's at the top in terms of making money and the deep pockets involved.
Yeah, you know, and it's funny because when we first started, you know, when you first started sort of mentoring me and I was learning things from you, you know, the music business hadn't really hit that Napster thing yet.
Yeah.
And I think it was like 2002 when they started firing, you know, their entire ADR departments, and budgets went from $250,000 down to $25,000. And it was kind of at that point, you know, it was again with, you know, Richard at Euphonics at the time. He was like, yeah, there's this company and I already knew the System 5. So it made sense. And then of course I made more money.
Yeah. Right. Pockets are deeper.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you can charge more. I mean, some of these stages charge, you know, $600 an hour.
That doesn't seem to have changed for a long time.
Yeah. I mean, it's gone up, you know, it goes up a little bit, you know, here and there, you know, but I remember when I was at this place, you know, and I think a lockout for 12 hours was $2,000, and it's less than $200 an hour.
Yeah. For music, the price really hasn't changed in 25 years.
I mean, granted you'd have to still pay the engineer separately. So
yeah,
that would bring up the cost, you know, to maybe, you know, $4,500, depending on the engineer. So, and then, you know, the room came with an assistant. So still, you know, if it was, you know, 5,000 a day, that's still pretty, I guess it's just depends, you know. I mean, I got off topic.
Well, you know, before you were talking about how the mic could change for each different take and then you have to match them. When you're matching, is that a matter of EQ?
Well, that's something we mixed from a mixing point of view. Yeah, it'll be a bit of an EQ thing, you know. From, you know, the editorial standpoint, it's just hearing there's a difference because you're not going to be EQing from one line to the next on the same track. You're going to want to use a different EQ. You know, if the first line is a little tubby and you take a little bit out, but the second line is a little dull and you're going to want to bring up the brightness of it, you're going to need two different EQs, and trying to EQ it as they're crossing over each other is just too much work.
Right. Now, of course, there's dynamic EQs these days, but even so, that's not foolproof either.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dynamic EQs are really cool. You know, it really depends on how your mixing style. It's like I like to have a lot of different EQs because some of them sound different. Some of them are very surgical. You know, there's amounts of compression, you know, too. And with dynamic EQ, if you're boosting or cutting something and it's got dynamics in it, it could change how the background noise is being presented. So you might hear it more. It might pump. I haven't really experimented much with it in terms of a post situation, just because I've got a chain that I like. But, you know, it might be something I might look into, just seeing how much it affects production dialogue. And maybe on AER.
You know, there's a new category of plugins that are intelligent, and I think that Auto Align probably falls into that.
Right.
But that being said, things like Nectar, are they useful to you? Do you see things that are post-centric that are more in the intelligent side?
Yeah, but again, it's just one of those things. I haven't gotten that much into experimenting with it on the mix side just because I've had my template for as long as I've had, and I kind of know how it works. I probably should take some time. I think part of the issue is when it comes to a lot of these newer plugins, a lot of these post-production stages have their set plugins that they like that are in all the rooms, so that if you go from one room to the other, you can, the license already lives there. So they don't have to keep buying different licenses. And with, I don't know if you've known all about this whole motion picture sort of standard that the new studios are having to deal with, because there was a post-production place called Larson Sound that had, I think it was Daredevil or one of their shows, Orange is the New Black, was stolen off their server. And this hacking group said, if you don't pay us $250,000, we're going to release it.
Wow.
And that was a Netflix show. And so a lot of the Motion Picture Association decided that, okay, we're going to create a new standard that these studios have to follow. And it, like, all of the assistants are locked in. It's like you can't even get to them unless you've got a key card. So everything has to be done, you know, through Aspera or another. Everything has to be encrypted. Hard drives have to, with this one show, I'm using encrypted hard drives.
Wow.
You know, where you have to type in a code just to even access the hard drive, because if the hard drives gets lost and there's a show that hasn't been released and there's the picture right on the drive, then anybody can do whatever they want with it. So it's gotten a lot more stringent to the point where if the Macs live in the room, then they hot glue all the ports. So you can't plug in an external drive.
I love it.
I know. It's a little overreactive, I think. You know, I understand that there are some, you know, companies like Marvel and, Apple certainly won't allow anything off-site. And the biggest issue is the picture. I mean, the audio doesn't really, I mean, what good is the audio? I mean, if you've got 60 gigs worth of dailies, what does that give you?
Yeah, sure.
The picture, that's the one that they want. You know, especially if the guide tracks are, even if it's not mixed and has all the professional sound done, it's still a valuable thing. And so the biggest place and the biggest holes are at the VFX houses, the layback houses.
Yeah.
They're the ones that are dealing with the picture. You know, us lowly audio guys, you know, it's all we get, an offline picture that doesn't even have all the final VFX in it. So we're less likely to be the ones to ever, you know, leak something like that. Mm. I mean, when Walking Dead had that big poll, who did Negan kill thing, they did that at Warner Bros. We didn't have any of those standards at the time, and nothing got leaked. I mean, people could have just even posted it on the forum, and nobody did, because we respect our clients.
Yeah, sure.
You know, we don't want that stuff to get leaked out there.
Okay, Jason, last question.
Yeah.
What are the challenges that you're facing? Meaning that, you know, you look into the future and you see things that are about to happen or things that you think that will happen. What are those?
Well, I think one thing was technology is growing exponentially. I think when I first started to really put my room together, I had kind of already had thought that question there, because at a lot of these facilities, they're not spending money on the editorial rooms because the stages are where they make the money. So these editorial rooms are running on really old systems, and they're really slow and they're really cumbersome to edit. If you want to process something, you can literally, if I quit smoking like 4 years ago, but I could literally go out, have a cigarette, and come back in, it would still be processing. So I think going forward in the future, it's how am I going to expand? You know, Apple just came out with their new Mac Pro, which starts at like $6,000.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to be one of those things where I've got the last of the 12 core cheese graters, as they call them.
Yeah.
Actually, I have two now. And when they didn't come out with this new Mac Pro last year, I was like, okay, there's got to be a way I can expand this thing because, you know, the Magma chassis are still $2,000, you know, to go PCI Express to the chassis. I was like, it's just way too much money. You know, I don't really need 7 cards. You know, maybe I would, but so I finally found this company, and what I did was I bought a metal compatible graphics card to put in this little expansion chassis, all for about like $1,300. And now I've got 5 outputs. I got one HDMI that goes directly to my picture monitor, and then dual port for my other monitors, and then I added USB 3. Which is much better than FireWire. Put some USB 3.1 hubs in, and now I just run everything off of USB.
Interesting.
So it's really the technology. Where's the technology going to go, and where am I going to upgrade? You know, is it going to be 5.1? My room's a little too small for 5.1, but there's a consideration of maybe a small set of speakers in here.
Yeah.
That would be one of those things I'd probably be asking you about, because I don't think upgrading the Avocet to 5.1 would be a good thing to do because it's adding 2 more of those units, but maybe getting a Grace instead. You know, when I bought the Avocet, the Grace only had a 2-channel, and I didn't like the dangerous one at all. And so now Grace has I think it's a 7.1 unit. I think it's like $4,000, but it still cost me more than $4,000 just to upgrade the Avocet. I love that thing. But so that's those are some things that I'm thinking of in for future. If I move, or if I'm, you know, able to buy a house here, would I go 5.1 there? Would I move the studio to another place, open up a mix room? These are some of the things. Would I leave Los Angeles? I mean, and do everything remotely.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been thinking, you know, Nashville's a great place to invest and, you know, get out of LA, move to Nashville, work out of my house.
Yeah, sure.
A heck of a lot cheaper to buy a house there. You get twice as much.
Yeah, no kidding.
So that's my future thought is, am I going to be here in 10 years or am I going to try to do it remotely?
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, Google Play, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-in form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.